We are in an interview with Mr. and Mrs. Lilburn Gottman in their home in North Manchester, Indiana, on Sunday afternoon, the 9th of April, 1978. I wonder, Mr. Gottman, if you would want to get us on the road here by giving us a background of your family, your parents, grandparents, their location, and sort of, let's get the Gottmans in focus a bit.
I was born in Colorado in 1911. My father's name was Charles P. Gottman. He was born in 1887. My mother's name was Anna Bell Copeland, and she was born 6 years later, so that'd be 1893. My mother was originally, all of her life, was a member of the Church of the Brethren. My father was a member of the Lutheran Church. He was born in Missouri and went west and met my mother in Colorado and married her there. We moved from Colorado in 1920 to Missouri, to a little town called Center in the Mark Twain country, just away from Hannibal, about 20 miles. I lived there until I graduated from high school and went to McPherson in 1929, graduating from McPherson in 1933. Grace and I were in the same years of college all of the way through, and we graduated at the same time. We had, I guess from the time we were in college, our careers will tend to run along together.
Fine. You know, we might, and I didn't indicate it, but we might ask you to add a little other information if it comes to mind. Do you happen to have in mind the names of... say some of your uncles and aunts, the siblings of your father and your mother, and of yourself?
For myself, I had one sister, Anna Roberta, who married A. Heckman, which is the same surname as my wife had before we were married. She has passed away now. She passed away from cancer a few years ago. My father had one sister and two brothers. His sister's name was Callie Gottman, and she married a Bross in Palmyra, Marion County, Missouri. The oldest brother in the family, my father was the baby of the four children. The oldest brother in the family was Casper Gottman. He spent his last years with Grace and with me here in North Manchester. The other brother was Herman Gottman, who worked for Bemis Bag Factory back in the early days in Wichita, Kansas, when he worked in Kansas City. And then when they set up their plant, which was originally a little branch, then grew into a main plant at Wichita, Kansas, they manufactured bags for grain and flour and this kind of thing in that plant. Now that covers my father's side of the family. My mother's case, she had one sister. Her name was Tressa. Tressa married a fox, Al Fox, and also married that was her second marriage. Her first marriage was to Floyd, Mr. Floyd. The youngest boy in the family was Kenneth Copeland, who moved to California when he became a man, worked in the highway department out there, and because of tensions that developed, I believe, this was the cause of his death. He died of a heart attack. Then there was one other brother who lived. There was one child in that family who died in infancy, whose name I don't remember at all. But I had another uncle, Clyde, who was a veteran of World War I, a man whom I admired very much, quite an interesting chap, who never had any children. He married and lived there at Prowers and near Lamar, Colorado, for all of his adult life, and he's passed away now. His wife is living at the present time in Emporia, Kansas. Violet, his wife's name is Violet. Now that gets my mother was in a family of five children. Her father's name was Charles Copeland, and his wife's name, or my grandmother's name, was Mrs. Jenny Copeland. She was a Wilson before she married my grandfather. I think that explains then the families of my own family and my mother's and my father's families.
Fine. Thank you. Now, Mrs. Butman, would you be willing to give us the background of your lineage?
Well, I was born at Mount Morris College while my parents were in school there. My father was J. Hugh Heckman. He was the youngest in a family of several boys and one daughter, one girl. Those people were I.D. Heckman, W.T. Heckman, John Heckman, B.F. Heckman, Ellen Heckman, who married Elmer Wagner, and my father. There were others in the family. There was a set of twins and two others who did not live past infancy. Their homestead was in Illinois, and several of them were missionaries. B.F. Heckman died in China with smallpox when he was a missionary there. Ellen Heckman Wagner was a missionary to India, and her husband is buried there. Uncle I.D. and Uncle W.T. were ministers in Sierra Gorda and Southern Illinois. My father had poor health from the time he was a young boy, about 10 or 12. He had tuberculosis of the bone in the knee, and so he was lame. And many times going to school, he would sit outside and be in the sun instead of being in the classroom. Perhaps I should go to my mother's family now. My mother was Jenny Sellers Heckman, and her family lived in Fostoria, Ohio. She was in a family of six girls and one boy. I think every one of those, except my mother and Ira France's wife, who was Hattie Sellers, went to Manchester College at some time, but Aunt Hattie and mother were both students at Mount Morris. John Sellers, mother's only brother, became a chemist after he finished at Manchester College, and he taught at the University of Illinois, and then he went from there to a university in Michigan in Ypsilanti, and he taught there until he died of a heart attack. He was there, I think, 20-some years. My Sellers relatives all were from Ohio, and I don't know any farther back than that. Mother's mother's family was Whitmore's, and there were three in her family. Then to come on down to myself, I guess. I was born at Mount Morris, as I said, and after my father graduated from college, we moved to Chicago, Illinois, where he attended Bethany Seminary. And after he finished his work there for a BD degree, he took work at the University of Illinois in the Divinity School, and then he became a teacher of Bible and philosophy at Bethany Bible School. So I went to grade school there until I was in eighth grade. At that time, my father's health had become pretty poor because of the tuberculosis in his system, and the doctors ordered him to leave the city and go to a sunny climate. And at that time, there was a pastorate open at Santa Ana, California, where we thought we were going. But while we were down at my grandfather's, David Heckman's, in Sierra Gorda, Illinois, a telegram came from Ira France, "Won't you please come to Fruta, Colorado? We need a pastor." And that really overjoyed my mother because she thought California was on the other side of the world. And to go out there to her sister and be near her in a little valley in California was really... in Colorado, was really something she had hoped for. She had wanted to be near her sister who had moved out there. So we spent 3 years in Colorado, in Grand Valley, God's country, beautiful mountains, wonderful people. And my father became so much better health-wise that district conference time, Dr. Swam was our speaker out there, and he approached my father about coming to McPherson College as a Bible teacher there. They were in need of one. My father consulted his doctor, and he said, "Well, you are much better. Colorado will always be here. Why don't you go and try it?" So in the spring of 1928, my father left Colorado in February to go there, second semester of the term, and see if he could, how his health would take it on a part-time basis. He loved the work and it seemed to get along just fine, so we moved there in the summer of 1928, where I finished high school. I went there for my last year of high school and then was there for 4 years of college. A few outstanding things in my college career. Professor Hess, he was then, stands out because he was my major professor. He was very, very kind to our family, helped my father in ways that he needed it health-wise. And then I think of Miss McGaffey, who married Dr. Bright, who was my French teacher. And I think of Miss Lehman, who was my German teacher. And, I can't begin to name all the professors. I took a course under Dr. Hershey. And, my mind goes blank now for some of the others. But the last year that I spent in high school, at McPherson High School, I was really marking time because I wanted to get up there to the college. I knew a lot of the people, and my heart was in it there. I'd like to say this. When we were in Chicago, I was baptized by Reverend Richards, who was the pastor then when I went to McPherson, and who had also been a pastor in Colorado when Lilburn was a boy, so he knew him. Then when we moved here to Manchester, Reverend Richards was our pastor here. So we followed him around, and he has had a great influence on my life and Lilburn's too, I think. I must not omit the importance and the friendship of Dr. and Mrs. Schwamm to our family. My father often said that he and Dr. Schwamm and Reverend Richards were a triumvirate. Dr. Schwamm, president of the college, Reverend Richards, the pastor of the church, and my father in the Bible department, and they would consult and consider and committee on our front porch or there in their homes or ours many times. And not having any relatives right there in McPherson, the same way with Schwamm's and the same way with Richards, we were often together for Thanksgiving and for Christmas dinners. And I remember many times in the Schwamm home on Christmas Day, there'd be anywhere between 20 and 30 students, 20 or 30 people, a few of us families, and then many of them students who lived in Idaho or some distance away who didn't go home for Christmas, but they would be there enjoying the hospitality of the Schwamm home.
How long did your father teach at McPherson?
My father was only there 5 years. He went in 1928, and he died in April of 1933, the year that Lilburn and I graduated. He suffered a lot of that time, and Mother was very conscious of the need that he had for resting and not overdoing, but he loved his work, and he gave his all to it. I did neglect to say that I had a brother, Paul, 2 years younger than I. I didn't say when I was born, but 1912. Paul was born in 1914, and my sister Vera was born in 1917. We all three graduated from McPherson College. and we're very happy that we went there. My brother died in 1937 while a student at Bethany of a nervous breakdown. Many people told him when my father died, now you must follow in your father's footsteps. You must take up the work that he was not able to continue. And he had never really considered the ministry. He wanted to be on a farm. But I think so many people told him that he felt he should really do that. And so he went to Bethany, and it seemed as though he really took on more than he should have. He preached down in the jail, and he helped with Chinese Sunday School, and he worked in the library and taking heavy courses. And then he had held a summer pastorate up in or near Bemidji, Minnesota, the summer before. And some of the teachers at Bethany told us that he carried the problems from that church back with him, because in some of his letters on his desk, they found that he had a lot of problems that people would write to him about, and he would try to answer all those along with his schoolwork.
When you were in Western Colorado, did you ever know S.Z. Sharp? Was he still there when you were there?
Yes, sir. I remember going in his house and helping to clean sometimes. He lived just about a block from us, and we would take food over there. I can still remember him standing up in the church and shaking his finger and pointing to the youth and telling them what he thought about dancing.
Now, when was that?
It was all 3 years that we lived there.
That would have been 25 to 28,
right? We left Chicago in 25. But he was a wonderful person, and he's the founder of McPherson, isn't he? And I
would you have felt at that time that he was still alert and in command of all of his faculties?
Oh, definitely, yes. He was at church every Sunday morning. He would come over to our house and talk to my father sometimes, and he was a vital character in the whole community.
Did you accept his judgments as to how young people should behave, or did you start to react against it, or do you have a thought on that?
Well, I think I accepted him better than some of the things my parents did. There were a lot of dances in the community at the Armory. I always wanted to see one. I never got to, but that was because of my parents, not because of Dr. Sharp. But S.Z. Sharp, I can see him yet going down the streets of Fruta in his buggy. He rode a horse and buggy. He was in a horse and buggy. I think he never had a car. At least I never saw him driving one. And that was how he was killed. You are probably aware. A car hit the horse.
I was not aware of that.
We were living in McPherson at that time, and he was brought back and buried in McPherson. You probably have seen his stone. It isn't too far from my father's stone.
Do you have a little more in mind? I'm sure we could get that written record, but I don't have it in my head about how long would that have been after you left out there?
Oh, I would say, I don't think it was more than 3 or 4 years after we left, because I married in 36, and it was before I don't know whether it was while I was still teaching or, but I would say around 1935.
What kind of a farming operation did he have out there?
S.E. Sharp?
S.E. Sharp. Was it very much of a thing? Was it just sort of eking out a living? What's your judgment about it?
Well,
would you have thought of him as being poor?
No, I don't think poor, but I wouldn't have thought of him as a farmer. Now, he had a nice big garden. He even raised celery, the first celery I ever saw raised. But
did he sell truck stuff, or what was that? I had the notion at some point that he sold some truck stuff out there.
It could very well be. Now, he lived with another man by the name of Saul Boggy. They were both, Saul had never married. Yes, he had. He'd married, hadn't he? I'm not sure about that. But I know Saul sold a lot of his things. I always thought of Dr. Sharp as just doing writing and studying and things like that. I'm sure he had a garden, but a lot of the church people would take food into him. He would find food sitting on his table when he'd be out somewhere and come back home.
Must have been appreciated as sort of an elder statesman or something.
Definitely. Yes, he was. And I think the people in town, I know they respected him. And they did feel that he needed a woman's care in caring for his clothing. I know many times they felt that, you know, they should have gone to the cleaners, but people didn't take them to the cleaners as they do now, and women would go in and try to help clean up. Two elderly men, I thought he was 100 years, he seemed like 100 years old to me then, but I think he was in his 90s when he died.
He couldn't have been very young.
No.
Been around working at McPherson College 50 years sooner than that, 40 years sooner than that when it was found.
True. I think he was over 100 when he died. Or was he right near 100?
I have to confess, I haven't done that kind of work on him. I just was reflecting. Mrs. M.S. France also lived in the Pruda Church. She was a kind. Her name now escapes me.
A Negi.
No.
There were Dylan Negis, and she was a... No, there was somebody there related
this
to
this woman. Was one of the kind girls she is now the second wife of M.S. France in Napa, Idaho. But she was there in the
Edgecombe? No.
No, Minnie.
Minnie Edgecombe.
It was Dick's older sister. And I can't remember her first name. But she was there, I think, in the early 20s. And you may not have known her. But I know she reflected on the fact that S.Z. Sharp was a bit of a stickler for people wearing the right dress. I think she mentioned that when they went to let her out of that church, Sharp raised the question as to whether or not she should be granted a letter because she had a little too much lace on her dress, and he thought that was too worldly, and he was raising the question whether she should be granted a letter. I gather that you sensed a little of that conservatism in Sharp.
Definitely so. I don't think there was any special action taken on anyone while we were there. But in a year or two previous to our going there, we had lost some very good members because a lady wore a hat. And her sister stayed in the church. She said she stayed and fought it. But Mrs. Elk went over to the Baptist church. She wasn't going to... Her name was Ilk, I-L-K. I can't remember her first name, but her sister's name was High, H-I-G-H.
Is she related to some of the Highs that were at McPherson, do you know? Did you know Orion High?
Oh, yes, and Mildred High was in our class.
She's Campbell now.
She married a camel,
yes.
That's right.
Lavina was
Lavina.
In Salmon when
yes.
we were, and Vera was.
Yes.
But this is not the same.
No,
not the same.
No. A sister to a Mrs. High, who's out there now, she was a Brimbaugh, and two Brimbaughs went to McPherson College from there, Donald and Earl. But Mary was older and married and didn't go. But they were related to the Highs.
Could you tie us in? Well, maybe she's picking up this kind woman.
It isn't in here.
I can't remember her first husband's name either, but then we'd let that go for now.
I'm not sure it wasn't Grace.
Yeah, I think it was Grace.
Grace Kine. France.
She's only been married
Grace
to M.S.
Kine.
France a few years.
No, it doesn't ring a bell with me.
Well, I know she was there in the early 20s. She's quite a lot older than you are. I think they probably were grown.
Now, I think... Others may not, but I feel that because we went to McPherson, people at Fruta, Colorado heard more about McPherson than they would have otherwise, most likely. And we had a number of students who came there then. There were several from the Fred Brown family. There was Clarence Brown and Alice Brown and Mary Brown. I think they're the only ones. There were 10 in that family, but I think they were the only ones who came. And then Ralph Keady came from that, and he... from that community, and he graduated from there. And Charles Austin, who was in our class, he's a nephew of Oliver Austin, who was well known in over the Brotherhood because of his evangelistic services.
Now, did you two people know each other in Colorado? Did you didn't have any, when she was at Fruta, you had no way of knowing her then?
She didn't go to 28, and I came in Missouri in 1920.
Yeah.
He came as a freshman, and because his name was Gottman, and my name was Heckman, we sat together in classes and in chapel until our junior year, and then a very fine young lady who had gone to El Dorado Junior College 2 years and who was blind came, and her name was Griffiths. So in chapel, in some of our classes, our junior and senior year, she sat between us, but a lot of people still made fun of us because a blind girl between us.
Well, you know there are two people awful close to you that sat side by side in freshman English class in the chapel. Her name was France and mine was Flory. So I'm I sometimes wondered by what coincidence does the alphabet bring people together.
Did you meet in college too?
Yes.
Well,
we met in freshman English class.
Some other things that might be of interest. Lilburn, I don't know who was president first. I was president of Christian Endeavor at the church, and the next year he was. And then our senior year in college, I was president of YWCA, and he was president of YMCA. And we marched down the aisle in the installation service. And then at the end of our senior year, when we installed the new officers, we marched down the aisle again. And we had started going together at the end of our sophomore year, so of course we were teased quite often. But and then, after I finished college, I taught 1 year in Marion High School and 2 years at Miller High School, both in Kansas. I wanted to get my life certificate for teaching and also pay my school debt before I married. And then I moved to Missouri in 1936.
Now, what about your combined experience? Could you bring us up to date on that?
I'll tell about the master's degree. I began attending University of Missouri before we were married, and then I received my master's degree in school administration in 38. And the year I was married, I became superintendent of a small high school and grade school. Missouri had a lot of small school districts at that time, and the superintendent was responsible for both of these. And so we were at Center as superintendent for 8 years. And then we moved from Center to a town called Monroe City, which is west of Hannibal on highways 36 and 24. And I was superintendent there for 8 years. So 8 years superintendent of Monroe City and 8 years superintendent at Center, and I taught at Center 2 years. I was in education in Missouri for 20 years. I'll let you tell about the family.
Well, Lilburn got his master's degree in 1939, and I got my MA degree by having a daughter by the name of Evelyn Louise in, I said 1939. Then in 1942, Judith Ann was born. They both live in here in Indiana now. Evelyn married David Bickle in 1959, and they live in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Judy lives in Bloomington, Indiana, and has two children, Christine and Douglas. The oldest child that they had died at the age of 8 and a half after 5 and a half years with leukemia. Judy is director of social services at Bloomington Hospital and is quite a busy lady. This came about after her experience of losing a child and feeling the loneliness that comes when you are watching a child die. Evelyn is an Avon lady in Fort Wayne, so she keeps me in jewelry and cosmetics. We're glad that they're both in the state. We see them fairly often.
Could you bring us to Indiana now from Missouri? And I think it would be helpful to explain something of the nature of your work here.
Ira France, who was a writer for the Sunday School Teachers Monthly for a number of years, lived in North Manchester here. And at that time, when we decided to come in 1952, he was working in the basement of the administration building, writing and publishing tests that were used in the elementary schools and the high schools of Indiana. His partner was A.R. Eikenberry, who was a professor at the college, who was about ready to retire. And the two men had developed an efficient and a well-organized service to the public schools of Indiana. This was through the cooperation of the county superintendents and was a going concern. They were looking for someone to come and participate in the business to whom they could turn it over to when they got ready to step out and retire. And so they offered the opportunity to us. This looked attractive to us because of the fact that we had two girls whom we wanted to attend college. And so we moved into North Manchester in 1952. And very shortly, A.R. retired from the business, and then subsequently, Ira retired from the business. Then in the early 60s, the schools of Indiana reorganized. The thing that had helped our business considerably was the cooperation of county superintendents. And in that reorganization of 61 and 62, the county superintendents were discontinued. We no longer have county superintendents as they existed then. There are a few county units, four or five. Huntington County has one superintendent. But it isn't on the same plane as the old superintendents. And as they developed the bigger school corporations with their own opportunities and equipment and secretaries for duplicating tests and so forth, it became evident to us that the business did not have a strong and bright future. At that time, I was a member of the local Board of Education, and an opening developed in the social science department at the high school, and I was talking with the superintendent and was able to work out an arrangement whereby I moved into the high school. I taught in the classroom for 5 years, and about that time in Indiana, partly across the United States, but about that time in the middle 60s and 67 and 68, there was a lot of uproar about child discipline, about dress codes, about long hair, and partly because of the influence of the college here and some of the professors, some real crisis situations developed in the high school. And the Board of Education asked the principal to leave. I think this was the most unfortunate situation as it developed. I was working with him and felt that he was treated unfairly, that he had a real tough situation to handle. But I had been teaching government, and that's the only class I taught, had a fair rapport with the students, I thought, and the board thought, so they asked me if I wouldn't take the high school principalship. My wife and I thought that one over for 3 or 4 weeks, because I was well aware of the hazards of such an undertaking. I did not want to take an impossible situation in hand that near the end of my school career. I didn't want to leave Manchester, and I couldn't decide whether to stay in the classroom or go into the administration. But the superintendent finally persuaded me to take the high school principalship, and so I was in principal of the high school then for 7 years. So I worked in public schools in Manchester for a total of 12 years. And now we retired. We retired in 1976. In the last day of June, and we've been very happy in our retirement. We have a number of things that interest us and that we're happy about. If I may, I'd like to say one or two things about some of the things around McPherson that we appreciated. Grace and I have both been happy that we were students at McPherson. Our experiences there were rewarding, and we appreciated them a great deal. I think one of the people we both appreciated a great deal was Professor Hess. He was her major professor. He was my debate coach. I was out for debate all 4 years.
I was interested somewhat in athletics. I made the traveling squad in basketball. But as I started my junior year, it became evident to me that the load of being on the varsity debate team and playing basketball was just too much for one person to try to carry. So I dropped out of basketball. I felt reasonably sure that I could have a successful time in debating, and basketball was certainly would have been a problem. I don't know what I could have done there. But we had, my partner was, debate partner was Ward Williams, and we had four good men on the varsity squad all together. We won the state, the conference, or that we call it the state championship then, because the teachers' colleges didn't have a conference. So we won the state championship in debate. And then Ward and I were extremely fortunate. We were in the finals of the National Pi Kappa Delta debate tournament down at Southwestern. And Professor Hess, that was one of his favorite stories years after that. He had two good men who had gone down the year before. Keith Hayes and Jack Layman were fine debaters. And they wound up third in the tournament. And Ward and I were second. So when Professor S. announced this in chapel when we came back, he said, last year I took a couple of good men down to the tournament and we got third. This year I took a couple of kids down there and I'll never know how we got second, which was a very complimentary thing to say. The next year we won the state championship, but we lost out in the quarterfinals in the national. We had he split up. I think he made a mistake, although I never dared suggest to Professor Hess that he made a mistake. But Ward and I had been a good team, and he split us up in the next year, hoping to have two teams rate high in the tournament. And if he'd let Ward and let us work together, I think we would have had more success in that next tournament. Outside of Professor Hess, Dr. Bright was the man that I under whom I majored, and I have the greatest respect and admiration for him. I like him very, very much. When we were on the campus, there was the administration building, both Arnold Hall and Fahnestock Hall for the dormitories, the library. Parley Hall was relatively new, and they had the old gymnasium. We played our basketball games down at the community building downtown. That just about set up. There was a married folks dorm there, Klein Hall, where there were a few couples who were married there, but the campus was fairly small, compact, friendly, and I think wonderful influence. Dr. Swam had an influence on me quite a little. I was quite happy that I was one of the people chosen to drive Dr. Swam. If you may remember, Dr. Swam patterned his driving habits after Otho Winger, which meant that he got in a car and herded it between the ditches from one town to another, and regardless of who else was on the road. And he wanted young people to drive for him as much as possible, so he would be relaxed when he got there to give speeches. And I can still remember some of the points that he made in this. He had a commencement address, which he delivered all over Kansas, all over the state. And I remember some of the points. I remember particularly he talked about back in, see now if I can get my dates straight, right around when Caesar was in Rome and he decided to cross the Rubicon, he went by chariot and by horse. And when Charlemagne decided that he was going to take over the, set up the Holy Roman Empire and went down to Rome, why, he went by chariot and by horse. And when Napoleon conquered Europe and went down to Egypt, he went by chariot and by horse. And then all at once, after that, the world began to come alive and the modern era came into effect. And he did that very dramatically, pointing out the value and the need for education, and that we needed people with vision and understanding and skill and training to live in a world like this. And it's interesting that after all these years, that would have been 1932 that I went up there. Then I was still maintained my interest in tennis. We were conference champions the year I was a junior, and a couple of guys graduated and weren't around for the next year, and we weren't quite able to pull it across as we had the year before. But I have many, many warm memories about McPherson and the influences and things that were involved there. I think the YM and YW were influences in our lives. We went to YM and YW conference out at Estes Park back in the days when dollars were hard to come by, I'll tell you. But I remember my dad arranged to borrow $50 to help put the expenses of going out to Estes Park. And it was an experience of inspiration that I've never forgotten. never forgotten.
Our class of 1933 can be remembered as the class of the Depression. We did not have a college annual that year. You won't find an annual for 1933. You will find our pictures as graduates in the 1934 annual. We did not have a class play. None of us bought class rings or class pins. Most of us did not get positions of any kind of work the next year, and Lilburn was one. He went home and worked helping his dad make fence and did that. I was lucky enough to get a position teaching Latin at Marion, but I got that job the Saturday before school started on Monday, and every school board member told me that the reason they selected me was because I would take it for the least amount of money. Mrs. Tate, who was a music teacher at the college, was also applying for that job. So many people were out of work and wanting positions that there were many, many, but I took it for $70 a month, and so that's why I got that position.
You have commented, both of you commented at one time or another about Ira France. Could you tie us in here a little, your relationship to Ira France you mentioned? Could you give us some assessment of Ira France? And I have to confess, we didn't even recognize that he had gone to McPherson. I understand he's written some things about his difficulty in hearing. Is there some way you could develop that for us a little bit? I'm sure we can read it, but maybe as a relative, if you could help us put a little life in that story, it would be good.
He has been hard of hearing practically all of his life. And after he finished college at Mount Morris, he tried to teach school, but found it very difficult because students knew that he did not hear, and this was before the time of hearing aids, and they would pull a lot of tricks and say things that, anyway, it was not good for the schoolroom. So he went into the pastorate then. Maybe he told you when you were talking with him, or you may have heard that one of the teachers that he had at McPherson told him that he didn't belong there. They didn't think he had a good mind because he didn't answer, and he wasn't always as attentive, but he tried, and he just couldn't hear, and that was his problem. Have you heard that?
We've heard that story, and
it is on tape.
I wish he had told you that.
We would have liked to have had him put that on tape, but we didn't think it was feasible to try.
Well, it was Dr. Harnley who told him that. He was in his class, and he just didn't answer questions or answer them as if he had understood the question, and so Dr. Harnley didn't think he had a good mind. But Uncle Ira wrote a play entitled What Shall It Profit? That was printed by the Elgin, our printing press at Elgin, and it really went over well. Are you acquainted with it? It was a temperance play, and I think most of the young people's departments in our churches over the Brotherhood gave that play. I know I saw it several times. And then after that he wrote a peace play. I don't think I can recall the name of it, but...
The 11th Mayor.
The 11th Mayor.
I know that. I was the first mayor when I was in high school. We gave that play all over Iowa.
Well, good. Well, I saw it...
How were you related to her?
Didn't I say that? Well, my mother, Jenny Sellers, was the oldest one in the Andrew Sellers family. And Hattie Sellers was next oldest. Mother and Hattie were both at Mount Morris College, and I don't know exactly how they met, but anyway, Uncle Ira France, and Hattie Sellers were married the year before my parents married, and then my parents married and were there at the college also. Ira France always tells people that he was my first babysitter. I was considered a college baby. There weren't very many babies in colleges in those days, but J.E. Miller, who was president of Mount Morris, called me the college baby, and Uncle Ira and Aunt Hattie lived there until he finished college, and then he started teaching in Kansas, Beatty, Kansas, I think it was, or Summerfield, around there. And then he went out to Colorado, and he was a farmer, a Colorado farmer there for a while, and then he became editor, owner, and publisher of the Fruta Times, and he was doing well at that until Aunt Hattie died in childbirth, and
how long did he publish the Fruta Times? Do you have an idea on that?
No.
Was this a weekly paper?
A weekly paper, and it formerly was called the Mesa County Mail. It was one of the few papers in the county, and then he put on a contest to have it for a new name, and it was called the Fruta Times. And he was doing well at that work, but he grieved so over Aunt Hattie that, and when she died in 1930, he had four children. Ruby France was the youngest. She was in about first grade, and Galen was next. And to help the family for a while, both Galen and Ruby lived in my home. They came to McPherson and lived with us. Galen for 2 years, Ruby 1 year with us, and 1 year in the Schwamm home. Schwamms wanted to give her a home, and they really wanted to adopt her, but Uncle Ira was not. She married Benton Rhodes, J. Benton Rhodes from Illinois, and she is now our Church of the Brethren representative in Washington, D.C.
Let's see, we stopped you there, and you didn't get the other two children.
Robert France lives in Harrisburg, Illinois, and Royal France works for Frigidaire and lives in Dayton, Ohio. Then I'd like to go back. My father, from the time he was in Bethany, and then all the time he was at Fruta, and until his death in Kansas, in McPherson, wrote for the Brethren Teachers Monthly, the lessons in everyday life for the Sunday school teachers. And on his deathbed, in April 1933, Ira France was there, and Uncle Ira offered, well, in fact, he wrote some of those Sunday school lessons for my father, the last about 6 months or so before my father died, because he wasn't able to. And from then on, Uncle Ira wrote them, I think, as long as they were still printed for the Brethren Teachers Monthly. He has been an editor and a writer, and he now has, I don't know whether he told you this yesterday, he has written three novels, but they're too goody-goody, and he cannot find publishers who will print them.
We didn't talk to him that much. It was not much of a conversation yesterday, so we're glad to have you, Phyllis, and we would have been glad to have gotten this from him, but he didn't communicate.
If you ever have a chance to talk with Ruby, she could give you more information about that, because she attended college here, and she would know more about that.
I had the privilege of working with Ira for a number of years while he was still in his prime. And he had a marvelously keen mind, a good insight, a good sense of humor. And he wrote quite a number of short articles and so forth for the Christian Century, for The Messenger, it was Gospel Messenger then, Christian Herald, and certainly was a very, very top-notch man. It was certainly a privilege to work with him and associate with him and appreciate the way his mind operated in that kind of a situation. He told me the story about Dr. Harnley and his underestimating Ira France one time when he was chuckling because of it. He said that Dr. Harnley came to him after Ira was writing a lesson in everyday life, came to him at annual conference one time and said, Mr. France, I kind of indirectly owe you an apology because I just thought you were a half-wit when you were going to McPherson College. And he thought...
Was he reluctant to let it be known that he was hard of hearing?
Well...
Where did he break through on this? He somewhere or other must have...
Well, it was a problem. They didn't have effective hearing aids at all. And then, if you may remember, the first hearing aids that they had were like the big Kodaks that hung on a strap around your neck and would be, I'd say, 8 inches long by 4 inches wide by 2 inches deep. Not very effective, but they would help pick up some things. And, of course, when he carried that, it was obvious immediately, here's a man who can't hear very well. And
Ira's father and mother were Jacob and, I don't remember his mother's name, France. And his mother was the deafest person I had ever known. Whenever we tried to talk with her, we had to yell in her ear as loud as we could. And she never did have a hearing aid. And I don't know whether I know his sister, Velma Gear, was also very hard of hearing, that it may have been a hereditary trait.
Sounds like Ruby is.
And Ruby is having a little difficulty, but she has a hearing aid in her glasses, and I don't even know it.
Ira was almost in seventh heaven as they perfected hearing aids, so that he could have a small one, 3 inches long by 1.5 inches wide by 1/2 inch deep, with small cells for the energy within them. This just made him extremely happy because he would put this under his shirt, and it wouldn't be immediately obvious that he was wearing a hearing aid. You might hear him sometime tuning it a little sharper and so forth, or you might hear a slight whistle. But he said it was certainly a gift from God that they were able to. He had 20 at least, maybe more years of good hearing as a result of the improvement of hearing aids, which was certainly wonderful. Then he worked here in the Bureau of Tests. Oh my, I don't have the years real clearly in mind now, but in, 58 or 59, when did he go down to Rossville? Or to?
He was gone when we built the house.
In 60, that's right, 59 or 60. And he had always said he'd like, since he had a hearing aid, he'd like to go back into a pastorate for a while. So it wasn't Rossville, it was next to Rossville, the Pyramont Church. They had some real problems between ultra-conservatives. There's some old order folks in the community and some of the real conservative people within that congregation and some folks who were a little more liberal. And pastors just could not make it go. And Ira France went in there and with his gracious manner, with his very fine sermonizing, and with his common sense, he went in there and finished his active career as a pastor, and just did a very, very fine piece of work.
Now, this was in the church close to Rossville,
right.
Indiana?
Yes, Pyramont.
It isn't far from Lafayette.
It's interesting. I like to humorously say to him, they had a parsonage that was just about as big as the church down there. Had a real fine parsonage and a relatively small church. But he certainly made it go. He really made a fine contribution there.
Well, I certainly concur in the observations that you've made. I remember Ira France not only from these plays, but I don't think I remembered your dad writing for the Sunday school stuff, but I sure do remember Ira France and common sense.
Yes.
This always made the lessons,
yes.
And I have heard a lot of people say something like that.